In the most recent edition of the Milwaukee Mafia podcast, we learn about the murder of Harry Grimacki Sr., who's listed as an operator of bowling games and other amusement devices. That starts the story that takes us to the Ballastreri crime family, a story that our next guest knows too well. Gavin Schmidt is the co-host of the Milwaukee Mafia podcast. He's also the author of 10 books about Milwaukee's mafia, the most recent being The Big Safe. Look forward to getting into that. But if you have questions about the history of organized crime or its present, join our conversation. 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Gavin Schmidt, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a shame that Larry's retiring, but, you know, you're doing great.
I appreciate that very much and echo your sentiment entirely. So this murder that starts your most recent podcast episode, this took place in 1974, and you've really been focusing on the mid-70s recently when it comes to your research on the mafia in Milwaukee. Why is that?
Well, I've tried to make the podcast roughly chronological. So
Okay. We've
been doing this for a few years now, and we've reached that point now where we're at 74, 75. So really getting into the years that people still remember, which I think has probably caught more attention from people.
So when would you say that the mafia, which I believe you describe as Southern Italian organized crime families, when does that get its start in Milwaukee, Gavin?
It's hard to say exactly because, you know, a secret organization doesn't really publicize, but definitely firmly by 1913. But I would go so far as to say they were probably already setting up shop maybe a decade prior to that.
What's starting in 1913 that set you off?
That's just when we know they start making newspaper headlines. The head of the mob at the time would get, they didn't call him the mafia. They didn't call him head of the mafia in the newspaper because they didn't really know what that was, but they'd call him like the king of the Italian colony in Milwaukee. And so, like, I don't think that the newspaper reporters quite knew who he was, but they understood that he had a lot of say over the daily goings on in the area.
And how was it that you, Gavin Schmidt, became involved and got to know one of the family members of the Ballastreri family, which was considered one of the crime families in Milwaukee?
Well, kind of a strange story. So you're referring to John Ballastreri, who was crime boss Frank Ballastreri's son. John had reached out to my publisher and wanted to meet, and I agreed to meet. This was probably 10 years or more now, probably 2014. And we met at the Pfister Hotel, and that first conversation was a little tense. He obviously wasn't too happy with me sharing some of the stories I was sharing, but as it happened, he was working on his memoirs at the time, and he thought, well, you know, if someone's going to do it, you're the guy who should probably look them over. So I spent a fair amount of time with John editing his memoir. Unfortunately, he passed, so I don't know if they'll ever see the light of day, but
interesting, but you talk about some of what John Ballastreri wrote, specifically about his father, Frank Ballastreri, and Frank was considered the crime boss in Milwaukee at one time. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think anybody who lived in Milwaukee from the 1960s through the 1990s would know the name Frank Ballastreri. You didn't have to be Italian or interested in crime. he was making headlines all the time. On the Senate floor in the early 1960s, he was identified as the crime boss of Milwaukee. And the newspaper used every opportunity they could to kind of reuse that quote from the Senate for the next several decades. So he was always a major figure, even if he did the smallest thing.
So what sort of crimes or vice was the Frank Ballastreri running in Milwaukee at the time? What do we know about what he was doing?
The core of any mafia family generally comes down to gambling. Okay. He's got a whole network of bookies that pay up to him during the different sports seasons, particularly basketball. So that's probably his core moneymaker. Specifically in Milwaukee, what sort of makes Frank stand out is his interest in jukeboxes, which wasn't quite as prevalent in other major cities. And he allegedly used his influence to get more and more jukeboxes in more and more places in Milwaukee, which doesn't sound like a major crime, but the key thing of that is in that era, everything was coin operated, which when your number one priority is avoiding paying taxes, the more you can do in cash, the easier it is to underreport your income. So,
well, and may not think about it these days, but back in the day, you had cigarette vending machines that people would get their pack of smokes from.
Yes, and I think that's a key thing because in the mob world, there's what we say is, you know, things that fell off the back of the truck. And certainly cigarette trucks are known to have been hijacked. And if you hijacked a cigarette semi-truck, then put those cigarettes in a cigarette vending machine, you didn't pay for the product up front, and then you can jack up the price on the machine higher than you would get at, you know, I don't know, a grocery store or wherever. And you're getting a premium on something you didn't even pay for in the first place. So, yeah, there's a lot of money to be had that maybe, you know, a dollar here and there adds up fast.
Especially if you've got a corner on the market, as you mentioned in the latest podcast, Milwaukee Mafia podcast, Donnie Brasco actually mentions, or Joseph Pistone, who was Donnie Brasco made famous from the 1997 film, actually talks about Frank Balestrieri and his involvement with these vending machines in Milwaukee.
He does. Yep. So if you read the Donnie Brasco book, The majority of it takes place in New York, but he does have a chapter where he's in Milwaukee and he helps set up this false business where they're going to, him and another FBI agent named Gail Cobb are going to move in and create a vending business with the idea that by setting one up, they're going to get threatened. They're purposely trying to get threatened. That was a major undercover operation in the late 1970s. And Joe Pistone, sometimes I give him a little flack for maybe exaggerating his role, but he absolutely was in there. He had sit-down meetings with Frank Balestrieri. He recorded some of those meetings. He boasts a little bit, but he can absolutely claim that he was right in there, met all the guys, and got some real incriminating information on them.
Now, I've heard stories of Chicago mafia actually using Wisconsin as a getaway or a place to hide away. But what are some of the other connections to some of the other areas that the Milwaukee mafia had?
Sure, absolutely. So, yes. Chicago notoriously, I mean, not just the mobsters, but Chicago in general, you know, they like going up to Door County and everywhere else. But there's a real strong link between the two mafia families, the Milwaukee Mafia and the Chicago Outfit, and directly even into the Balestrieri family themselves. Now, Frank Balestrieri's elder son, Joseph Balestrieri, his godfather was a man named Phil Eldericio, like his literal godfather at baptism. And he was in the 1970s, briefly the head of the Chicago Outfit. So it's not just, you know, the different mob families throughout the country are doing business with each other. They're kind of part of each other's literal families.
Wow.
So these links are really strong across the board.
What about the mobsters in Milwaukee, and did they connect to other hot spots like Las Vegas?
Yes. I argue that Milwaukee is probably a key piece, if not the key piece, in Las Vegas in the 1970s. They tend to get overshadowed by Chicago and Kansas City and other places, but the man who received loans from the Teamsters to invest in the Stardust Casino and the other casinos that were mob run in the 1970s, that man's name was Alan Glick. And Alan Glick got approved for the Teamsters loan on the say-so of Frank Balestrieri. So if Milwaukee did not okay Alan Glick, Alan Glick would never have owned the casinos in Las Vegas. So, you know, Milwaukee's always going to get overshadowed by Chicago. Again, not just in mob world, but in everything. But you cannot deny that there was an absolute linchpin piece there, on top of the fact that after Alan Glick started owning the casinos, Frank's two sons, who we've already mentioned, Joe and John, were the attorneys for Glick's corporation that ran the casinos. So they were intimately involved in the day-to-day financials from the legal standpoint.
What do we know about the mafia in Milwaukee today, Gavin?
Well, that is probably the most asked question and probably the hardest to answer. I, in my personal opinion, I don't think there is. I believe that it largely died out in the 1990s. There might still be a few stragglers, but, you know, and people have come up to me and they've told me they've seen envelopes passed over bar tops and things like that. So is there something there? Maybe, but the violence hasn't really been a thing since the 1980s, so it's not obvious. And again, like the number one moneymaker is gambling. And now today, all we have to do is open our phones. So the market for bookies isn't quite what it used to be. We've kind of legalized everything that the mob was making money off of. So
yeah,
is there a mob in Milwaukee? It's certainly possible, but I think if there is, it's just a shadow of whatever it was. So.
Gavin Schmidt, our guest, author, historian. He hosts the Milwaukee Mafia podcast. What questions do you have for him? Join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Miller Show. Larry Miller returns tomorrow on The Larry Miller Show, and his guest will be Dr. Zorba Pastor. Join with your questions as Dr. Pastor provides a roadmap for a better, healthier 2026. Better and not as yet to be seen. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Larry today, and our guest is Gavin Schmidt, historian and author. His most recent book, The Big Safe, which we'll have to get into. He also hosts the Milwaukee Mafia podcast, and also want to mention the Fox City's Murder and Mayhem podcast, which has a lot of mayhem in the most recent episodes. So I'd encourage you to check that out as well. And with all of our guests and all of the information that we provide, including our firefighting discussion in the last half hour, you can find those links after the end of the show anytime at your leisure at WPR.org/Larry, along with all the other podcasts. Or if you want to hear Larry's old shows, they're all up there for you anytime you choose. So check that out, WPR.org/Larry. So, Gavin, let's talk about your most recent book, The Big Safe, and how it relates to the organized crime families of Milwaukee.
Okay. What do you want to know?
Well, this is a sort of a violent story. We haven't really gotten into any of the violence that surrounds the Milwaukee Mafia, but this one has some murder involved.
A little bit. Yeah. It's not the focus, but inevitably violence is sort of the mob's way of cleaning things up.
Mm-hmm.
No, so the Big Safe is the title is supposed to sound like a film noir. So if it sounds like an odd title, that's like the illusion I'm going for. But in the 1950s, there was a man in Reno, Nevada named Levere Redfield who was a multimillionaire but didn't believe in banks. So he kept all his money in the house. Word got out and a boxer in Reno told his friends in Milwaukee, who happened to be mob-connected guys. They drove cross-country from Milwaukee to Reno just on this rumor, and they ended up burglarizing this man's house. And there's sort of different variations of how much money he took, but somewhere between 1.5 and 2.5 million was taken all, in this house, and they didn't even find it all. Like, there was a hidden room in the basement they didn't even know was there.
With more money? That had to be one of the biggest burglaries of its time.
It was estimated to be the biggest burglary of its time. Later on, there's a more famous case of a Brinks truck getting robbed. That was a bigger deal. But up to that point, yes. And if you adjust for inflation, $1 or $2 million in the 1950s in today's money, I don't have that exact number, but it's even more than it sounds. It's a lot.
Let's go to your questions now at 1-800-642-1234. We'll start with Tom and Ripon. Tom, good afternoon.
Hi, how you doing, Larry?
Good. What do you have for us today?
I'm just wondering about, I'm from Finlac originally, and there's always rumors and innuendos of, mafia infiltrating the cheese companies around Finlac. I don't want to say what cheese companies there were, but there was it was kind of not so well kept secret that the mafia ran these cheese companies, including putting muscle on little cheese factories outside of Farm Lac. And one occasion that I've heard that one little cheese farmer or whatever had a cheese factory outside of Farm Lac went missing and they never found them. Wonder if the if you know anything about that.
Tom, that is a great question. And the first time I heard about the Milwaukee Mafia was working at a pizza joint in Madison, my first job in the mid-90s. And interestingly enough, in the last few minutes of your most recent Milwaukee Mafia podcast, you make mention of pizza, Gavin. So I'm wondering what you make of Tom's story.
I'm familiar with Tom's story. I appreciate him not actually mentioning any company name.
As do we.
The company name that he's probably referring to still exists. So I try to, for legal reasons, I try to not say that name. But yes, there is a long history of mob involvement in Wisconsin's cheese going back at least to 1940, if not earlier. It was born out of a Chicago businessman who came up to Fond du Lac and started the company, and they ended up having a minor war over ownership. There were three or four guys who were killed over ownership. The guys who took over the company after that had connections to the Bonanno Mafia in New York. Mm. And then as late as the 1960s, 1970s, the father-son, again, I'm going to try to avoid using names. The father-son duo that owned this particular company was always listed on the FBI's list of known mafia members. So it's more than a rumor. They've definitely been looking into that for a long time. And yes, there's definitely evidence of them pushing out smaller cheese companies. I believe we did a podcast episode of one rival cheese company where the owner was found dead in his car, and officially it was ruled a suicide, but the man's wife, this is a man named Summers, the man's wife actually pushed for an investigation because she believed that this other company had basically pushed him out by, you know, making it look like he had asphyxiated himself.
Wow. Organized cheese. And it's interesting, yeah. The latest Thomas Pynchon book that had loosely based on the Milwaukee Mafia refers to the crime leader as, I believe, the Al Capone of counterfeit cheese. So it continues to make it into the fictional world as well, but there is a factual story that is to be told. It sounds like the Fond du Lac cheese wars. Let's go to Irene in Janesville next. Irene, good afternoon. You're on with Gavin Schmidt.
Oh, terrific. I'm very excited about this. And I wondered if you could tell me about other legislative or police or law enforcement or politicians who were involved with the mafia, either in Milwaukee or elsewhere.
Ooh. Okay.
Ooh. Gavin, how would you like to answer that?
Well, this is where I usually give Milwaukee a lot of credit. Again, comparing them to Chicago notoriously had judges bought off. There was a few famous investigations in Chicago, one called Operation Greylord, where they found that judges were literally taking bribes to let murderers go. And we don't really see parallels like that in Milwaukee. Like, there's some low-level stuff. We see vice cops kind of looking the other way for a bottle of wine. We see there was a judge named Chris Serafim who was caught going on vacation in Hot Springs, Arkansas with some of the bookies, but there was no proof that he did anything wrong, that he just happened to know them. The mayor of Milwaukee famously for decades denied that there was organized crime in Milwaukee, and people always kind of wondered why he denied it when everybody else knew it was there. But relatively speaking, as far as corrupt law enforcement and politicians go, Milwaukee is clean. I guess I can't say that today. I don't know. But over the extent of the mafia years, it was always very minor. Like there's an isolated incident here or there where there was a man named Max Adonis who wanted to injure another man, and he was able to get a police detective to release a photo of the man so that he could pass the photo around saying that that man's life was in danger. But like, that's the extent of it. He didn't get the officer to do anything, like do the violence. He basically just got him to release a mugshot, which is pretty minor on the grand scheme of things. So,
but also kind of fitting with what the general assumption would have been about Chicago politics versus Wisconsin politics, that there was sort of a divide there that was more than just the borderline. I have an email from Cheryl in Superior who points out that Jimmy Hoffa's body has never been found. Cheryl had a college roommate that thought he was in one of the lakes in Upper Michigan. Any comment on that, Gavin?
Who knows? I don't know if she's familiar, but just in the last year or two, they used ground penetrating radar to see if he was under the old county stadium in Milwaukee.
Oh,
like, so the talk of him being in Wisconsin, like, that's generally we think that he's somewhere farther east, but it does come up. He did have Jimmy Hoffa did have a lodge up in Eagle River, so he clearly does have the Wisconsin connections. But I don't know more than anyone else does where he is.
Jim in Middleton emailed to ask about the story of Isidore Pogrobe. Are you familiar?
Yes. So he ran a bar/strip club called the Brass Rail. This would have been 1960, and one night he's leaving, he gets forced into a car, brought out to Mequon, is shot in the head and dumped in a culvert just outside of Mequon. And they never solved it. As with most mob murders, they never solved it. But by sheer coincidence, who takes over the Brass Rail after his death? Frank Balestrieri. So definitely seems like there's a connection there. The suspicion was always that Izzy was getting hijacked liquor, getting his liquor cheap, but wasn't paying his bills on that. So again, who knows? Officially, it's unsolved, but there's definitely more than a few links tracing back to Frank on that one.
It reminds me of going back to your relationship with Frank's son, John Balestrieri, that you had up until his passing at the age of 75 a few years ago. The three most dreaded words that he would ever hear from his dad. Got a minute? So it sounded like Frank was kind of a scary guy, and maybe John was intimidating as well to begin with. Do you think that the Balestrieri story will ever be able to be told through you, Gavin?
Like John's story?
Yeah. Wherever his biography lies today.
I really hope so. So that I have the manuscript. The manuscript is... it needs some editing, but it's definitely, it's A to Z complete. The real hurdle right now is I'm not exactly sure legally what I can do with it because the author does not live. So that's a bit of a hurdle, but if I can figure out a way around that, I'd love to see it published, because John's stories, and they're not just mob stories. I mean, he knew all kinds of famous musicians. He set up a theme park in Italy based on the Renaissance.
Gavin, I apologize. We're out of time, but we'll have to keep up with you on the Milwaukee Mafia podcast, the Fox City's Murder and Mayhem podcast, and your latest book, and hopefully we can have you back again. Thank you, Gavin. Thanks.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. And thanks as well to our team today, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnaud, Jeff Robbins, Brad Kohlberg, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. Larry Mueller returns tomorrow with Dr. Zorba Pastor as his guest. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to WPR News.